Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. On today's show, we are discussing media coverage of last week's violent attacks on the U.S. Capitol. CNN reports that in a new court filing, federal prosecutors said last week's rioters intended to capture and assassinate elected officials. The allegations were written by Justice Department lawyers in Arizona who are seeking to keep Jacob Anthony Chansley in jail. Chansley is the man known as the QAnon shaman who wore face paint and bullhorns on his head. Federal prosecutors also say that Larry Rendell Brock, a 53-year-old retired Air Force Reserve officer who was arrested in Texas, carried zip-tie restraints to possibly restrain or detain people. A prosecutor said he means to take hostages, he means to kidnap, restrain, perhaps execute members of the U.S. government. Robert Sanford, a 55-year-old retired firefighter, has been arrested for allegedly throwing a fire extinguisher at a group of police officers. Kevin Seafried, the man holding a Confederate flag inside the Capitol, was also arrested with his son. 38-year-old Olympic gold medalist Cleet Keller turned himself into authorities yesterday. He is charged with three crimes in U.S. District Court in Denver for his role in the riots. Yesterday, FBI Director Christopher Wray said more than 200 people have been identified as suspects. CNN reports at least 44 people have been arrested on federal charges. At a press conference on Tuesday, Michael Sherwin, the U.S. acting attorney for the District of Columbia, said, quote, "I think people are going to be shocked with some of the egregious contact that happened within the Capitol." Well, joining us to discuss media coverage are two guests. Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch, an independent website that critiques media coverage of the top issues of the day. In a piece called "It Took Thugs Roaming the Halls of Congress for the Media to Speak the Truth," Dan Frumkin writes, "I find it pathetic that it wasn't until they had the visuals they needed that the elite journalists of the Washington Press Corps could bring themselves to call what Trump has been doing since before the election by its proper name, an attempted coup." Hi, Dan. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, it's great to be here.
It's great to have you back. We're also joined again by Jesse Wegman, a member of the New York Times editorial board, where he has written about the Supreme Court and legal affairs since 2013. Jesse Wegman is author of the book, Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. A couple of days ago, the New York Times editorial board wrote, "More Republicans need to be honest that the election was not stolen. Law enforcement needs to be transparent about the threats facing the nation." Hi, Jesse. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, every day, it seems like every hour, there's so much new information coming out, but there are still so many questions that we all have. Dan, I just want to ask you, what really strikes you about all of the information coming out?
Well, it's quite overwhelming. As you said, it seems like every few minutes, there's more and more coming out. I think that what you're seeing in the media is an appropriate, sustained attention to just how absolutely unparalleled, outrageous, and dangerous this assault on the Capitol was. At the same time, I do actually worry that we're taking what Justice Department officials are saying a little bit too seriously in terms of, I'd like to see some evidence of these things. But so I don't know for sure yet whether these people were basically talking about assassinating people or actually had the intention, for instance. So I'm a little bit skeptical of that element of the story. But overall, what you're seeing is sustained coverage of an outrage that has been going on for much longer than since January 6th.
Mm. Well, to be specific, I was looking for more information about what they are saying about that QAnon shaman, which is what he goes by. And that's when this line came out that the rioters intended to capture and assassinate elected officials. The Washington Post reports that this is based on a note left by this man for Mike Pence. And he wrote, "It's only a matter of time. Justice is coming." Jesse, before you tell us about what your overall thoughts are, what do you think about Dan's comment that he wants more information about these specific charges?
I mean, I agree that we always need more information is always better. I am not that skeptical, at least based on what we've seen already, that at least a not insignificant number of people who breached the Capitol were intending to inflict bodily harm on lawmakers, if not kill them. You read this in online chatter. They were saying it out loud, literally on the grounds of the Capitol in videos beforehand. They did kill a police officer. They attempted to kill others. Just given the language, given their physical behavior that day, I don't doubt for a second that this could have gone much worse, but for a few, twists of fate and the quick thinking of some Capitol guards. Mm.
And what are your overall thoughts, Jesse, just about all of the information that is coming out on a regular basis?
I mean, what we're seeing is the culmination of not just a few months of reckless and dishonest presidential rhetoric and the rhetoric from top Republican lawmakers. We're seeing the culmination of decades of lying and misleading by people in power on the right. This is not a bipartisan issue. This is not a political issue. This is an issue about one party in particular and the adherence of one party essentially making up stories about voter fraud in particular. Remember this, this election, the big lie about this election was that it was stolen through fraud. That is not a new allegation coming from Republicans. They have been alleging this for decades now and investigating supposed cases of fraud. Remember when President George W. Bush fired U.S. attorneys who refused to investigate fraud properly. I'm sorry, Alberto Gonzalez did this, his attorney general. This is a longstanding problem on the right of a refusal to accept the legitimacy of its political opponents. And this past week, it sort of exploded into actual physical violence and murder. But we should not mistake at all the longer term project that's been underway here.
Well, how do you think, do you think media coverage will change as a result of this? Because the last time we had you on, we talked about how we always hear that Washington is broken. These are, partisan issues. You hear this over and over again. So do you think this will change how the media cover what's really happening in Washington?
I mean, I'm speaking only as a member of the opinion department at the Times. And there, I know that, as long as I've been there, we have been calling out Republican efforts, particularly to lie about voter fraud for years. And I think that keeping the focus on that is really an essential part of placing the blame where it most appropriately lays. What I hope is that this sheer horror of what happened last week will shake the rest of us into ensuring that we don't slip back into the traditional tit for tat partisan storytelling that has so often characterized the way we talk about Washington politics.
What do you think, Dan?
I am not entirely optimistic. I do feel like there is this moment now where people, where news reporters are expressing this outrage about what happened. But I think it's mostly limited to the actual storming of the Capitol. Mm-hmm. And I see waves of political reporting behind it that are still absolutely engaging in false equivalence and that are reporting about all this, all these different controversies with what I would say is a very calm tone. And I think that calm is the wrong approach right now. I think that what Jesse said is exactly right. These are all things that have been going on for a long time. And if we are, and I think that I'd love to see the press emboldened by what they saw and these visuals to start calling these things out more assertively. But I fear that Jesse's colleagues on the news side will retreat back to their above it all false equivalent sort of approach to things.
What do you think it would take to actually change that? And people who are really engaged with the media, what can they do about it? Our listeners, for example.
I think the only way things will change is if the people at the top leave. And if the people and the younger generation asserts itself more clearly. I think you've seen, for instance, at the New York Times, this clear sense that younger reporters don't want to play this game anymore. But there has been, but there is such a thing as corporate culture in these news organizations. And as long as that corporate culture favors the reporters and the reporting that is, you know, is unflappable and presents both sides with a certain amount of equivalency, that's going to continue to happen. And it's what the people can do, what the people can do, mm-hmm. I don't know. I think they can support media outlets that don't play those games. They can express their views on social media. Those are two things.
Yeah, you know, and especially your point about younger reporters, also reporters of color. I mean, reporters of color have been raising the alarm bells for years. And some, I've seen a number of people on social media this week say, if we had been listened to 4 years ago, we knew what was coming based on the dog whistles, how Trump started his campaign saying Mexicans are rapists. I'm sorry to say that. I hate repeating that, but that's what he said. What about that, Jesse? I mean, a number of reporters of color, writers of color are saying, you know, we tend to be sidelined in many cases. We're not, in many cases, the ones making the decisions at major newspapers.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And it's something that has gotten, I think, appropriately more attention in recent years, certainly not as much as it deserves. But, you know, Ben Smith, our media columnist, I think did a really interesting sort of analysis of this a couple of months ago when he wrote about the way that the Ferguson protests and the police crackdown on them kind of really brought a lot of younger reporters of color, both sort of out of the woodwork and who had been there basically on the ground covering those protests. Kind of they fanned out and either sort of entered new newsrooms or developed a stronger voice within newsrooms that they were already in, and started to change the culture. I think Ferguson was really identified as a turning point in the way that newsrooms approached questions of race. I still think, you know, it's clear that we're far from doing this perfectly, but I do think this transition and this transformation, I should say, is really underway. I'm not trying to be a Pollyanna about this. I have to have more hope than Dan does. I think that these changes are going to stick, and that that Black and Brown reporters and writers particularly will be listened to more. But you know, this is all, we're watching this happen in real time, and it's hard to predict how it's going to go.
Yeah, I'd just like to add, I mean, I've seen some wonderful pieces written by journalists of color who have said that you're not listening to us, and that's the problem. And I think that's an excellent summary of it. I also, there was a tremendous anecdote in a column written this week by Margaret Sullivan, the Washington Post's media columnist, in which she described being at the Post on election night. And there was a Black woman reporter who was crying, and a white guy saying, "Hey, at least it's going to be a hell of a story to cover." Mm. And boy, I sure wish that someone had just sat there and said, "Okay, you're in charge now," to the Black woman. Right. That's what I wish had happened. And maybe it'll happen the next 5 or 10 years.
Mm. Yeah, that reminds me of what CBS CEO Les Moonves said in a call with investors. You know, Donald Trump might be bad for the country, but he's great for us. Go, Donald, go, because he was a cash machine especially for the networks.
Well, and to the extent that it was a great story, it was a great story that demanded them to tell the truth as assertively as the right wing media machine was telling lies. And they didn't rise to that challenge either.
Dan Frumkin is editor of Press Watch, an independent website that critiques media coverage of the top issues of the day. Jesse Wegman is a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. We had Jesse on to talk about that book a couple months ago, and you can find it at yourcallradio.org. We are not taking phone calls today, but you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. What really strikes you about the media coverage? What's coming out every day? And if you want to take the longer view about, you know, how we got here, and if you've seen some good pieces about that, what needs to improve, we'd love to hear from you. You can email us, yourcall@kalw.org, or if you use Twitter, you can tweet us at yourcallradio. I'd like to ask you both about how Trump supporters have been covered over the last 4 years and how last week's riots will change that coverage. Because, you know, we've been talking about just the wide range of people who support Trump, from the blue collar worker who voted for Obama and feels like the Democratic Party has just left them, to these right wing fascists and everybody in between. Jesse, what are your thoughts about how the media, and of course, you know, when we say media, we're talking major, like the papers, NPR, maybe the cable shows, how they've covered Trump voters and how you think this will change?
You know, I hesitate to opine too much. I know my job is an opinion. I hesitate to opine too much on the coverage decisions of the newsroom at my paper anyway. I will say I do think that the coverage has been much broader and I think more comprehensive than a lot of people like to give it credit for. There is a tendency among, I think, consumers of news to, you know, if they accuse newspapers and media organizations of false equivalence, I would, you know, respectfully charge them with a different kind of offense, which is to assume that if you haven't seen it in published in the newspaper, then it wasn't published. And I think that that contributes to a lot of the anger that you see directed at, say, the New York Times or the Washington Post whenever they run a story about, say, the iconic, you know, Trump voter in a diner in somewhere in Ohio, and, you know, getting angry that we've written yet again about these people when we obviously know what they're going to say. I think, you know, we're writing about a large and complicated country. And I think we also, you know, I see tons of stories about people who do not support Donald Trump and people of color and people, marginalized people, you know, really excellent, you know, wonderfully reported in-depth pieces that line right up alongside those other pieces that make people angry. I understand some of the criticisms of those pieces. And I think the paper and the editors have taken some of those to heart. I think some of them are fair. And I think one of the things that's great about the Times is there is an adaptation as, you know, people's awareness expands and as more voices and more diverse voices get included in positions of leadership. But, you know, I guess that's all my point is that, you know, the paper includes more than a lot of people realize. And I think it's worth looking at it as a whole rather than singling out individual pieces and then, you know, dunking on them on Twitter.
Hmm. You know, I read the New York Times very carefully and I read all sorts of other publications very carefully. And I do not see a ton of stories about people who oppose Trump. I don't. I do see routinely these sycophantic and stenographic interviews with Trump supporters where all they do is quote them saying these things, saying things that are lies and that don't make sense. And then say they still support Donald Trump. And I do feel strongly that after 2016 and still today, reporters should absolutely be talking to Trump supporters, but they should be not just taking stenography. They should be actually engaging in really thoughtful, deep, probing interviews to find out why do these people believe these lies? What is their news sources? What is their background? What made them susceptible? And especially, what can possibly get them to once again pay attention to the facts as reported by reliable, independent news outlets? And that's not happening. There was a fascinating post and video this morning from one of CNN's anchors who does a lot of voter panels, saying she doesn't want to hear from these Trump diehard Trump supporters anymore because they're just either they're lying or they're deceived. And I think it's interesting that perhaps there will be I'd like to see less interviewing of Trump supporters where you just quote their blithering and a lot more interviewing where you see them explaining how it is that they believe these things.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that up, because on NPR in the lead up to the election, this happened all the time, where you would hear someone say, you know, we're turning into a socialist country. This is a communist country. And I'm thinking, I wish the reporter would have said, well, what does that mean to you? Where are you getting this information? You know, to go a little deeper rather than just play a soundbite that makes no sense.
Exactly.
So moving forward, Dan, because again, Trump got over 74 million votes, more than he got last time. He's leaving in about 5 days, 4 or 5 days, but his supporters are not, and his Republican enablers are not. So this story is with us. What are your thoughts? And I saw that the tweet from the CNN anchor, I'm looking for her name. It escapes me right now. Allison. Right. Right. So you just have to wonder, okay, Allison, then what's next? How are you going to cover this?
Right. And I have actually on presswatchers.org on my website, I have actually called for a national reporting initiative to basically really explore this, because I think that there's a lot of interesting academic studies that are looking at misinformation, disinformation, and the spread of it. But I think that we need, as journalists, to start reporting on this epidemic of what I would call fact rejection. Our job as journalists is to create an informed electorate. We have failed. 74 million people voted for Donald Trump based on a campaign of lies. So what are we going to do about it? We could sit around and pontificate, and I'm all for editorials and opinions, but I really think our strength is in reporting. And what I'd like to see is reporters fanning out, you know, at local newspapers all over the country and exploring the incidence and prevalence of fact rejection in their communities, and then figuring out how it happened and what could be done to solve it.
You know, and one of the other major problems, and this isn't getting as much attention as I thought it would, but one of the targets of the mob was the media and journalists who were there covering the protests. According to the New York Times, a video taken by William Turton, a Bloomberg reporter, showed a crowd outside the building advancing on a camera crew, yelling, "Get out of here," and smashing equipment. Turton, who was in Washington to report on disinformation, said in an interview that those in the crowd turned their attention to the small media pen after police pushed them out of the building. After that happened, he said, they chased anyone with a camera. He said, I saw this Italian TV crew they chased out, and I knew they were Italian because I actually took the Amtrak down with them. And we did see horrible video of this poor AP photographer who was just punched and punched, thrown over the side of a wall. They stomped on his equipment. They poured water in it. We know that Murder the Media was etched on one of the doors in the Capitol. I mean, Jesse, this is another problem, this massive distrust for the media that was constantly egged on by Trump.
Well, yes, Trump and also the right-wing media entertainment complex itself, right? They've, you know, created a monster that is devouring itself. And you know, from Fox News to Breitbart to Newsmax, whatever you want to call it, you know, all of these, I won't call them news organizations because that's not what they are. They have been encouraging this way of looking at media and the people who, you know, push information or at least images and words to your computer or your TV screen every day for years. You know, I agree. It's terrifying as a member of the media. It's a frightening time to be in this job. I don't think anyone has been scared away by it, but it's certainly something that keeps you looking over your shoulder and worrying that the most unhinged of a very large movement of people who seem to be detached from reality could do real violence and have done real violence. So I don't know. I mean, Dan said that, you know, we have failed, and I think there is some failure that needs to be faced up to and addressed. At the same time, I think, you know, most reporters are working extremely hard and are doing their best under really trying circumstances. In most places, you know, newspapers are either folding or cutting back on coverage and or they're taking orders from, you know, publishing conglomerates with conservative bents. So I think there is a lot of pressure on people just trying to do the good, you know, baseline street reporting that I think would help provide a little more of a realistic and fact-based substrate for the American people so that we don't see this mass delusion that we're seeing right now. That's been the most terrifying thing to me. I've never lived in a moment of mass delusion where you know, tens of millions of people believe or at least claim to believe things that are just manifestly untrue. You can't argue with flat earthers and you can't argue with people who insist that this election was stolen or rigged somehow. It's just they're not interested in facts. And I think that's going to require a much bigger sort of a project of re-education than simply a few reporters changing how they, what questions they ask.
What do you think about this, Dan? What should be done about this right-wing ecosystem with all these conspiracy theories? NPR has a piece running this afternoon about people who've lost their family members to these conspiracy theories.
Yeah, it's tragic. And, you know, I think to circle back to what Jesse was saying, I mean, it's absolutely part of the message, which is that you cannot trust the media. I mean, if you look at Trump's actual speech, that rally, and you think about whether he would, what he was really inciting, he was almost inciting an attack on the media more than he was on anybody in Congress. He talked about how the media was the number one enemy of the people, and he virtually drew a target on the back of the camera people up on the risers there. So I think that you need to look at where it's coming from. And I often turn to something that Jay Rosen, the NYU journalism professor who I admire, says. He says, a counter-majoritarian party has to be counterfactual too. Mm-hmm. And so what they have done is they have declared the media to be the enemy. They've created this entire right-wing media structure that traffics in falsehoods and incitement. And what we do about it is, one thing that we could do about it, I'd like to see the folks who are in the fact-based, reality-based media be a little bit more assertive about declaring what Fox News and OAN and these other groups are, and not considering them news organizations anymore, but considering them propaganda organizations. I don't think Fox News should be part of, you know, part of the media establishment.
Well, today we are talking about media coverage of last week's riots, where we are today, what we can expect from the media with a Biden administration, because Dan, you know that the right-wing media, or we don't want to call it media, but the right-wing ecosystem, they're going to go into overdrive when Biden comes in. I mean, it's already starting. I flip on Fox once in a while to see what they're talking about, and they're just bringing up, you know, they're calling certain cabinet members racists. They're just going to go into overdrive. So what are your thoughts about what changes we'll see once the Biden administration comes in?
Oh, you know, I hadn't thought through that yet. That's a good point. I've been focusing more on how the, real news organizations should be covering the Biden administration. And one of my main issues there is that we should really be advocating for transparency. But no, you raise a really good point. It's going to be ugly. And I think what's going to happen is news organizations are going to see that part of their job is going to have to be affirmatively covering the lies and refuting them and as lies. I don't think you can, I think ignoring Fox News, which is what the media did for a long time, doesn't work. And so I think that actual fact-based news organizations will need to, A, you know, promote facts as assertively as the right-wing media sphere promotes falsehoods, but also actually confront them and give people material they need to have individual talks with their crazy uncle. And hopefully that'll help.
What are your thoughts, Jesse?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. That, you know... There are some conservatives around who care about fact-based journalism, but there aren't many. And that poses a really big problem. How do you reach outside of the audience that you already have and speak to people who are so invested in an alternate reality that is not grounded in fact or truth? And it's a big dilemma. You know, we face it at the paper too. You know, there are very few conservatives who could function up to the standards of the New York Times. And that's not meant as a snobbish comment. It's not about, you know, your politics. It's about being able to make arguments that are grounded in facts and reason, you know, which is, I thought, like sort of an Enlightenment value that we all subscribed to, except now it appears that a significant portion of the country does not. I think fact-checking is one part of it, though there is a futility to that I start to feel when I think, like, you know, I could, you know, like I said about the flat earthers, do you like sit with a flat earther and say, here, let me show you how a sextant works? Like, that's not going to get you anywhere. You know, it's good for posterity. It's good to remind the people who already read the New York Times or the Washington Post that this is reality. But how much does it actually break into the bubble of, you know, the conservative media entertainment complex? I don't know. And I've been pretty downcast these last few months, especially as I've watched right-wing sources and how they spin what's actually going on in the world and just sort of twist it up, you know, turn it inside out and then get a lot of positive feedback for it. So it's a frightening cycle, and I'm not sure in the end how to break it.
To your point, we just got an email from Brad who says, please, please, please raise the issue or the impact of radical right-wing radio. Rush Limbaugh, Mark Levine, Michael Savage, who on his last show called for armed insurrection. We need to change the libel laws or face the consequences of a perpetual open microphone propagating a constant barrage of lies and misinformation. He writes, this is not a few small groups or minimal amount of people they're influencing. Conservative numbers place their active listeners and supporters to between 15 and 16 million people. I haven't read this whole column yet, but it's on my list for the weekend. Nicole Hemmer wrote in CNN, why talk radio is ground zero in America's democracy crisis. What are your thoughts about this, Jesse?
Yeah, we ran a similar piece on that issue some months ago. And, you know, this brings up the classic debate, you know, incitement versus free speech. And we just the other day ran a piece by the executive director of Pan America arguing, you know, that we need to be extremely careful when we change or consider changing laws on speech to try to capture incitement, like the examples you're giving here, that we don't then accidentally create powers that then get abused by law enforcement in a way that punishes people for, you know, truly speech that really should be protected. I get that the whole line of Supreme Court cases, which is known as the Brandenburg versus Ohio, and the standard that was promulgated by that ruling is very protective of speech, and I get why that is. At the same time, I think that case is from 50 years ago. We live in a different environment now with social media that, you know, the people could not have envisioned at that time, and with avenues to influence that I think were not even in mind at that time. I do think it's worth, as we think about ways in which the law might be updated, distinguishing between average citizens and those with bigger bullhorns, whether because they are media figures, whether because they have massive audiences on radio or TV, or whether because they are political leaders. And I think it's worth at least having a conversation about whether people with that kind of influence should be held to a different standard when it comes to incitement to violence, because I think it's absolutely right that you know, Donald Trump's words, you know, when he says, you know, fight like hell, show no weakness, you know, are a lot more dangerous to the peace of the nation than, say, if my angry uncle said the same thing.
I worry a lot about trying to come up with legal law enforcement solutions to speech. I mean, I think we do have, you know, laws already that make actual clear incitement to violence a crime, but I think this needs to be settled outside of the law world. And interestingly enough, there was a piece in the Washington Post just the other day that, you know, the corporate overlords may have something to say about this. The Cumulus, the radio network, actually told its host to stop saying that, lying that the election had been rigged or was fraudulent. I think that what we should do is, as citizens, is look at the pressure, ways to pressure these networks with advertising, you know, their advertisers and their corporate owners, rather than try to actually throw people in jail for political speech, which terrifies me.
Mm, yeah, that's such a good point, and we're definitely going to do a show about that. Dan Frumkin is editor of Presswatch, an independent website that critiques media coverage of the top issues of the day. Jesse Wegman is a member of the New York Times editorial board and author of Let the People Pick the President, The Case for Abolishing the Electoral College. And you can find our conversation with Jesse about his book at yourcallradio.org. Dan and Jesse, thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Such a pleasure, and nice sharing the microphone with Jesse. It was really nice.
Thank you. Coming up after a quick break, we will go to England and we'll find out what coverage of the riots looks like in Europe. We will also talk about the COVID crisis there. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the COVID crisis in England. COVID has infected over 3 million people there. More than 84,000 people have died. Joining us is Beth Gardner, a London-based environmental journalist. Hi, Beth. Welcome back to the show. Hi, do we have Beth?
Hi. Yes, I'm here. Great to be
Hi.
With you.
Great to have you back, Beth. Before we dive in and talk about COVID, I just want to ask you, what was your reaction when you saw last week's violent mob enter the halls of the U.S. Capitol?
My reaction, oh my gosh, it was horrifying to watch it. And for sure, it was, a absolute top of the news here. And, you know, all the British people I follow on Twitter and all of that within, you know, minutes of the whole thing starting were, you know, that was the only thing anybody was talking about. So definitely, I think it's worth Americans understanding that the whole world has just absolutely been, you know, gripped by this crisis.
What has the media coverage been like where you are?
Pretty blanket. I mean, it's competing here with the, the COVID crisis, which is really peaking. And I know we're going to talk about that. But the coverage has been very intensive. I think there's been, a lot of antipathy towards Trump and the Trump administration here anyway from the beginning. And I think people are also, British people are sort of looking to their own government and, you know, questioning Boris Johnson's very close relationship with Trump for all these years, sort of now trying to, you know, distance himself a little bit. People remembering Theresa May in the early days of the Trump administration literally was photographed holding Trump's hand as they walked out of the White House. So, you know, people are sort of asking questions of their own government as well. And the media is doing that too, because, of course, you know, at the same time that America has been in the grips of this right-wing populism of the Trump administration, the UK has been in its own, enthralled to its own right-wing populism through Brexit and Boris Johnson. So, you know, people certainly are paying very close attention and are really transfixed. I think, obviously the UK has always seen America as a very close ally. And now that Britain has distanced itself from the EU through Brexit, you know, there's some real concern that things seem to be getting pretty rocky in the U.S.
Right. We haven't done a show about Brexit, but that's definitely on our list. NPR has been reporting it. There's another piece, just to let listeners know, this is for another show, but it definitely needs attention, by Christopher Miller and BuzzFeed. Far-right extremists around the world are drawing inspiration from the insurrection on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, no doubt they are. And, you know, all the same kinds of sort of far right groups and QAnon and conspiracy theories. You know, QAnon started as a conspiracy theory about Democrats and so-called deep state U.S. government. but it really has crossed the ocean to Europe now too. And, you know, you see signs and all that kind of language at, you know, anti-mask and anti-lockdown protests here in London.
Well, let's dive in and talk about what's going on with COVID. This new variant is really hitting so many countries hard. I mean, here in the United States, there was a piece in Vox that said health experts say you should avoid optional trips whenever you can. You probably need a better mask, too, because it's just so many people, sadly, are getting COVID and dying here in the U.S. What about this new variant in the U.K.? On January 4th, the Prime Minister announced another national lockdown in England, closing schools, asking people to stay home for all but a few necessary purposes, including things like buying food and essential work. Give us a sense of how alarming the situation is there.
I mean, the situation here is really awful. You know, I just read that hospitalizations now are the number of people with COVID currently in hospitals is 70% higher than at the peak in the spring, which, you know, was such an awful situation back then. London ICUs are so overwhelmed now that they are transferring critically ill patients hundreds of miles to other parts of the country to be treated because there simply is not the staff available to provide that treatment here in London. And, you know, obviously you don't put a critically ill person in an ambulance to travel hundreds of miles if you don't absolutely have to, because that in itself is dangerous for them. So, you know, that really tells you where we are. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just really been a very, very avoidable catastrophe, as in the U.S. Here, you know, the Johnson government, the conservative government, unlike Trump, you know, has responded when things have gotten really bad. But we've just seen this pattern over and over and over again of they wait too long. They sort of wait until the hospitals are already overwhelmed before they start imposing new measures. And this new variant has made things even harder because it's more contagious. So what that means is that the lockdown measures that would have succeeded in bringing the numbers down previously, you know, you need to do more lockdown actually to get the same reduction in cases. And it just gets harder and harder, obviously, because there's so much fatigue with it. And I just think it's really also worth mentioning and understanding that variants like this UK variant are actually a result of the failure to control the virus. Mm-hmm. And they're a result of, you know, the Johnson government's sort of ongoing flirtation here, I think, with this idea of sort of herd immunity, just let the virus spread, you know, protect the oldest and most vulnerable people, let them stay home and, you know, just kind of let the virus run its course otherwise. The British government has sort of veered between that mentality and then sort of a severe lockdown. But what we know from the science is that the more people get infected, the more you let the virus spread, the more you fail to suppress it. Every time the virus jumps to a new person, it has to replicate. And that's when you have the risk of mutations. And that's where these new variants come from. So the more it spreads, the more likelihood there is of these kinds of variants popping up. And therefore, it's not an accident that this variant came to be in a country, Britain, that has just let the virus spread, you know, to really catastrophic rates. Similarly, there's another new variant now in Brazil, which is another place that's really run unchecked.
And we should point out Harvard epidemiologist Mark Lipschitz in this Vox piece said, while these variants have not been shown to be more deadly, as you said, they are more contagious. So with a 50% rise in infectiousness in less than 2 weeks, you get twice the number of cases. And according to CNBC, in a piece last Friday, London Mayor Sadiq Khan said via Twitter, the threat this virus poses to our city is at a crisis point. 1 in 3 Londoners now has COVID. If we don't take immediate action, our NHS could be overwhelmed and more people will die.
Yeah, and indeed the NHS, which is the National Health Service, is now being overwhelmed. And, you know, that's why, as I was telling you, they're sending people to other parts of the country to be treated. You know, there's reports of ambulances waiting for hours outside hospitals to you know, in order to wait for the capacity to drop people off. That number that Sadiq Khan mentioned, one out of every 30 Londoners was infected currently with the virus. I think that was about a week or two ago. It might be a little bit better now. Mm-hmm. Nationally, one in 50. Unfortunately, one thing that is true about the way the British political system, works is that there's very little local power. So Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London, you know, has been expressing a lot of concern, but he really doesn't have the authority to make a lot of changes. It's a very centralized sort of national system here. So even in, you know, a very liberal-minded city like London, the decisions are being made by a, you know, very, very right-wing government. I guess another important thing to understand about the British system is that, you know, Johnson right now, what he was reelected pretty handily about a year ago. He doesn't have to face election for another 4 years. So the greatest political sort of pressure on him, and the only sort of, you know, pressure that he really seems to feel and listen to, is from within his own party, and indeed from the very sort of hard right, you know, wing of his party. And that, I think, sort of tension between the kinds of anti-restriction, anti-lockdown, anti-mask, you know, views coming from his far hard right is sort of been in tension with, you know, what he's been hearing from the scientific advisors. And Johnson sort of has this very kind of indecisive way of just, you know, constantly postponing the difficult choices. He gets caught between these two, you know, sort of competing views, and then tends to not act until things are already really bad. And as I said, because local government is not very empowered here, there's no level of government sort of insulating you, right? So people in California obviously are impacted by Trump's failures and the lack of any federal response, but you also have a, you know, governor who's making decisions to close things or open things or whatever. Here in the UK, you don't have that layer sort of insulating you from the national decision-making process. And in fact, even schools, you know, what happens in my daughter's school, every local school in the UK, it's not like a local board of education that's making that decision. It's sort of being handed down from the Boris Johnson government and his very right-wing education secretary sort of edicts about, you know, no masks in schools and things like that. So some of this is a result of this pre-existing political situation we were in with a, you know, very empowered, hard right conservative government.
Hmm. What about testing PPE? The United States has utterly failed on these issues. What is it like in the UK?
Well, Britain was, you know, in a pretty similar position in the spring, you know, with the nurses wearing garbage bags and things like that. I think, you know, a lot of developed countries in North America and in Europe just realized that all of that stuff comes like from China, right? So all those supply lines were interrupted. I think that has been a lot better now, and the PPE seems to be a little more adequate. There were also a lot of scandals here, cronyism and corruption and sort of contracts for PPE and masks and things like that being given to like neighbors of the health secretary and, you know, all that kind of thing, which has been really shocking. I think the PPE is a little bit better now. The testing capacity is better. But of course, what happens is that the numbers have just gotten so high. And through these failures, you know, Johnson created a special sort of allowance for people to see relatives over Christmas and mixing of households. It's been very poor messaging around masks. You know, still so many people here don't even really realize that the virus is airborne. And I think a lot of it just comes back to these failures by the Boris Johnson government to really take this seriously enough, except when, you know, it's already sort of too late. So the PPE is better, the testing capacity is better, but the case numbers are just, you know, through the roof. And that's why the hospitals are being flooded now.
Beth, we only have a couple minutes. The vaccine rollout in some parts of the U.S. has been going well, and other parts very, very confusing. Here in the Bay Area, Kaiser is now vaccinating people over 65. Yesterday, people said they were on the phone for 5 hours just to get an appointment. What has the vaccine rollout been like there?
Well, you know, it's slower than anybody really wants it to be. Obviously, the UK approved one of the vaccines, Pfizer, I think it was, a little bit earlier. I guess one advantage that Britain and other European countries have, where there is an existing, you know, sort of national health system,
right.
I think it makes it easier to kind of distribute and prioritize and roll things out in an orderly fashion. Whereas in the U.S., everything you're describing, which I've heard the same from my parents on the East Coast, you know, results from the fact that America doesn't have any kind of national healthcare or universal healthcare. It's this incredibly fragmented system where every county is kind of on their own, every, you know, hospital, every doctor's office is on their own. And it's just been chaos, obviously made worse by the lack of really any federal, you know, coordination effort. And I guess in the UK, there are problems, but they are benefiting the Brits from the fact that they do have this existing structure of a national health service, which is, you know, a pre-existing sort of coordinated system that allows things to be delivered in a little bit more of an orderly fashion. So, you know, rather than having to open to everybody over 65 and then all the websites crash, they're doing it in a more orderly way, I guess. They're first doing people over 80, and then they're doing, you know, people with health conditions, and then they'll open it to over 75. And I think it's just because they have that pre-existing infrastructure of universal health care.
Well, Beth, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we would love to have you back again to continue the conversation. We had you on many times last year to talk about air pollution, and we'd love to have you on to talk about that, especially its connections to COVID. So thanks so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's always great to talk to you.
You too. Thank you. Beth Gardner is a London-based environmental journalist and author of the book Choked, Life and Breath in the Age of Air Pollution. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr for engineering our show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.